Voss of Germany and Teresa Badio of Spain also spoke. The United Nations says Syria is on target to meet a deadline for destroying production equipment for its chemical weapons stockpile. Inspectors say they've been able to verify 21 of 23 chemical weapons sites, with the remaining two unreachable because they're located in a conflict zone. Syria is slated to destroy chemical production and mixing facilities by November 1st, a key milestone in the UN Security Council deadline for the chemical program's full destruction by June 30th. A polio outbreak has been confirmed among children in northeast Syria. At least 10 children in the province of Deir al-Zor have been paralyzed with the disease. The World Health Organization says it's Syria's first polio outbreak since 1999. With thousands of Syrian refugees fleeing their homes by the day, health workers are warning the disease could spread. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights has asked the U.S. to explain alleged abuses at Guantanamo Bay and grant immediate access to investigators. Citing the force-feeding of hunger-striking prisoners, one panel member said the available evidence indicates a, quote, general and systematic violation of human rights. On Monday, the U.S. ambassador to the commission, Lawrence Gumbiner, was also asked to answer questions over NSA spying worldwide. On both Guantanamo and the NSA, Gumbiner said he couldn't provide an immediate answer because the government shutdown left his team without enough time to prepare. A Brazilian judge has ordered a halt to construction of a major hydroelectric dam in the Amazon rainforest, citing the violation of environmental commitments. The $11 billion Belo Monte Dam project was initially approved over the objections of indigenous communities who have warned of ecological damage and mass displacement. A federal judge has ruled a key portion of the recent Texas anti-abortion law unconstitutional. On Monday, District Judge Lee Yackel struck down provisions that required onerous hospital admitting privileges for abortion doctors. The restrictions would have forced at least a dozen abortion clinics to close their doors. Texas Governor Rick Perry has vowed to appeal. The rest of the law goes into effect today, including a ban on abortion at 20 weeks post-fertilization. The initial bill inspired a people's filibuster and a stand from Texas State Senator Wendy Davis that thwarted state lawmakers' first attempt to pass it. State Senator Wendy Davis is now running for governor of Texas. Ohio is planning on using an unprecedented drug combination for an execution after a Danish company banned its sedative from involvement in the death penalty. Ohio officials say they'll be forced to use metazolam and hydromorphone on a death row prisoner next month. The combination has never been tried in the United States. Ohio says it's run out of pentobarbital made by the Danish firm Lundbeck and now banned from U.S. prisons that carry out capital punishment. President Obama appeared at FBI headquarters Monday to welcome new director James Comey. Obama told FBI staffers he'll fight to restore the agency's full budget under sequestration.
I'll keep fighting for those resources because our country asks and expects a lot from you, and we should make sure you've got the resources you need to do the job, especially when many of your colleagues put their lives on the line on a daily basis, all to serve and protect our fellow citizens. The least we can do is make sure you've got the resources for it and that your operations are not disrupted because of politics in this town.
Comey was sworn in at a private ceremony last month. He's instructed all new agents to visit the memorial to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on the Capitol Mall as a lesson of what he called, quote, the dangers in becoming untethered to oversight and accountability, unquote. Dr. King was subjected to extensive FBI surveillance and harassment in the years before his death. Penn State University has reached a nearly $60 million settlement with 26 victims of the child sex abuse committed by former assistant football coach Jerry Sandusky. Up to six other victims are not a part of the settlement and remain involved in talks with school officials. Sandusky is serving a sentence of 30 to 60 years for sexually abusing 10 young boys. Three former top Penn State officials are facing trial for their alleged role in the cover-up of Sandusky's crimes. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today marks the first anniversary of Superstorm Sandy hitting the East Coast.
KPFA brings the listening public the other point of view.
There was a strong sense that this was the beginning of something that would spread across the country.
On Sunday, November 3rd, at the historic Hollywood Theater, KBOO presents an exclusive benefit screening of the film KPFA On the Air.
This documentary tells the powerful story of the beginnings of listener-sponsored radio in the United States with the birth of Pacifica in Berkeley in 1949.
KPFA On the Air chronicles the origins of the free speech movement, the first stirrings of the student movements at Berkeley, and opposition to the Vietnam War in the early 1960s.
Eventually spawning a network of free-form, independent radio stations across the country, including KBOO, which came on the air in 1968. So come join us at the Hollywood Theater, Northeast 41st and Sandy Boulevard, Sunday, November 3rd, at 7 in the evening.
Help keep community radio strong and thriving into the future.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Vagabond Opera's 7th Annual Day of the Dead Bash, the Transylvanian Voodoo Ball. This concert and Day of the Dead celebration honoring the ancestors is coming up on November 1st, 8 p.m. at the Star Theater, 13 Northwest 6th Avenue in Portland. The neo-gypsy cabaret Vagabond Opera and the Russian gypsy punk band Chervona will play, along with many special guests. Bring mementos for the Day of the Dead altar to honor lost loved ones. There will be a costume contest with prizes. That's the Vagabond Opera's 7th Annual Day of the Dead Bash, the Transylvanian Voodoo Ball, at the Star Theater on November 1st. More information can be found on the right-hand side of the KBOO.FM website, under Community Events.
And you are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, also heard around the web at www.kboo.fm. Up next is the KBOO Evening News. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Marylhurst University, dedicated to helping working adults revitalize their careers by offering 5 part-time MBAs, including an MBA in healthcare management with evening, weekend, and online options. Listeners can learn more at the information session on Thursday, November 7th at 6:30 p.m. Details at marylhurst.edu.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News...
Protesters at a downtown U.S. postal office are arrested.
A national food chain pushes employees to sign up for the food stamp program.
The NSA testifies to defend methods of spying techniques.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 29th, 2013. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Nat Parker. Portland police arrested 4 protesters today at a downtown Portland postal facility. According to the Oregonian, the protesters were part of the Portland Communities and Postal Workers United, which represents letter carriers, postal truck drivers, and mail processing clerks. The demonstrators, which totaled about a dozen, filled the lobby of the main downtown post office at 715 Northwest Hoyt Street. Police were called when the protesters were deemed trespassers by facility operators. According to Greg Margulies, a spokesperson for the union, protesters wanted to speak with a postal administrator. Demonstrators were protesting the recent loss of jobs in Portland and Salem to provide to 2 private corporations. A flyer from the union claims the Salem plant is subcontracting low-wage, non-postal, and non-union work to replace regular workers at the plant. Meanwhile, it says Portland postal truck drivers are being put on standby in exchange for other similar workers. The U.S. Postal Service says the subcontracting is necessary to save labor costs in what it calls a financial emergency. A large police presence remained at the facility after the protesters were removed by police.
The Eugene City Council approved on Monday a proposal to allow 2 new homeless rest stops. The camp will house up to 15 people each and serve as a pilot site for future camps. Homeless advocates in Eugene have criticized the decision, suggesting that the camps will be insufficient in number and located too far from critical services. With Monday's decision, the city refused to grant legitimacy to existing encampments of protesters on highly visible land, including the camp known as Whoville. The city council has acknowledged that the temporary sites are problematic due to poor drainage and some suboptimal location.
In an ongoing issue with the U.S. Postal Service to stop privatization, several petitioners were pushed out of the U.S. Postal Office in downtown Portland while delivering a stack of petitions. At least four people were arrested, including Jamie Partridge, who is contributor of KBOO's Labor Radio, after hoping to speak with the postal administrator when a security guard stopped the demonstrators.
The old Freeman water tank is pitting the neighborhood of Woods Park against the Portland Water Bureau in a fight over green space and public participation. KBOO's Don Merrill has more.
The issue around the Freeman Water Tower isn't a new one. The ground-level tank at the corner of Southwest 42nd Avenue and Freeman Street has been defunct for 13 years. But since it was built, residents say the area has become a de facto park and nature area. 6 years ago, the property was declared surplus by the Portland Water Bureau, and that has residents of the Woods Park neighborhood up in arms.
I'm Jeremy Solomon, and I am one of a group of residents, neighbors, who formed a group called Woods Park Advocates, and we're really just a neighborhood group, an informal group of neighbors.
But not just any informal group of neighbors. This group has decided to go after the Portland Water Bureau for what they call an inconsistent process regarding the Freeman water tank.
Sometime this summer, we heard that the property might be for sale. I shared that news with my neighbors, and they were pretty alarmed about it.
So Mr. Solomon and his neighbors tried to get the Portland Water Bureau to stop the sale. But Tim Hall, a spokesperson for the Portland Water Bureau, said that can't happen.
It needs to be understood that because the Water Bureau and the city has a signed agreement with Renaissance Homes, that we cannot break that agreement without the possibly incurring legal fees and also a court challenge that we could likely lose.
One of the major issues the neighborhood and Mr. Solomon have with the way the Portland Water Bureau employed the sale was that the city didn't give the neighborhood a chance to preserve the property themselves.
We got no concrete information from the Water Bureau until, I believe, in September, when I asked them, after repeated calls, emails, point blank, what's going on. And I said, who, what, where, when. And we got an email back that, in fact, the Water Bureau had signed a contract to sell the property in September of 2012. When we learned that, we being the neighbors, we were very unhappy, A, because we had gotten no public notice, and B, because we had been inquiring about it for several months, and they were, the Water Bureau was evasive is maybe the best word to use, but I would say they were not truthful because they didn't volunteer the information to us. They didn't say that there was a contract to sell the property, which they could have right away, and told us the details.
The Water Bureau, with the approval of City Council, used city-approved methods to offer these properties for sale.
When you say city-approved methods, does that include public notice and that kind of thing?
Well, the way public notice is that it went through the city council, and the city council process has the way information gets out. The neighborhood associations, for example, they monitor activities of the city council. Could we have done more? Commissioner Fish has said yes, and that the Water Bureau will take steps in the future. In fact, one of the things my office is working on is a plan for public notification to do more.
The Woods Park property is pending sale to developer Renaissance Homes, but it's not the only property the city is selling. 6 years ago, the Portland Water Bureau decided to declare seven other properties as surplus. Are other neighborhoods as vocal as your neighborhood is?
Well, none of their properties. Well, one of them was about to be offered for sale, and it quickly was pulled. And I'm sorry, we've gotten support from other neighborhood associations, Ash Creek, Crestwood. So, and they immediately felt and voiced the same feeling. And so the properties were that were about to be sold, the Water Bureau said, oh, well, we're not going to sell them right away.
Yeah, those properties are still for sale, and we will go with the properties where they're not encumbered. We will be offering them for sale and doing a more extensive public notification.
I guess what I'm saying is it sounds like the process, in light of what's happened in Woods Park, the process has been enhanced.
I can understand why some neighbors, you know, want the Water Bureau and the city, you know, to personally, you know, notify them. And that's one of the things that we're working on, is making sure that the broader neighborhood, if they're interested in these properties, is aware.
Mr. Solomon says he and some of his neighbors will be speaking before city council next month about the issue. Mr. Hall says citizens certainly have the right to engage their government on issues they consider important. KABU will be following the story. I'm Don Merrill, KABU News.
As the government continues to face cuts on federal social programs around the nation, vulnerable families in Oregon will see their Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, benefits decrease by $36.17. On Wednesday, 41 members of the federal government policy known as Farm Bill will meet for a conference to discuss keep from passing a legislation from cutting billions from the SNAP program, also known as food stamps. Families and individuals in Oregon that receive SNAP will face reduced amounts starting on November 1st, which will also put over 1 million people around the country to see SNAP amounts reduced each month. The cuts to SNAP could also hurt food banks and shelters around the nation as well, picking up the slack to supplement the loss of what SNAP would usually cover. Officials and staff from Senate and House Agriculture Committees have met privately to discuss a 5-year farm bill, but the Wednesday's conference will not be behind closed doors and have plans to come to an agreement soon without any extensions.
An audio recording currently making the rounds on YouTube shows that the McDonald Corporation is actively encouraging their employees to apply for food stamps and Medicaid. Instead of offering higher wages and benefits to their long-term employees, the company is apparently suggesting that the employees turn to public assistance instead. Here's a clip of the employee calling the McHelp line, saying that she is having a hard time supporting herself and her two kids on her McDonald's salary, and that she's having to ration food.
McResource line, how can I help you?
Hi, I'm Nancy. I wanted more information about the help that I need.
I can give you a number that will be helpful. You can ask about things like food pantries. Are you on SNAP? SNAP is Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Food Stamp. Do you have kids?
Yeah, I have two kids.
Yeah. You would most likely be eligible for SNAP benefits.
You know, mentioning the food, I didn't know about this.
You know, it's a federal program. Federal money comes down to the states, and the states administer it.
And what about, like, the doctor?
Did you try to get on Medicaid? Medicaid is a federal program. It's health coverage for low-income or no-income adults and children. Let me find the number that you can call in Chicago, like, to find help with all of your questions.
That was a recording of an employee of McDonald's calling the company's McHelp line and being told that she should apply for food stamps and Medicaid to supplement her McDonald's income. The release of the recording comes just a month after fast food workers at McDonald's and other franchises across the country walked off the job to protest low wages.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned for Out Loud at 6. Tonight's Out Loud welcomes Wild Planet Radio, a new queer online radio station in Portland, Oregon. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's Hard Knock, David D. speaks with original Black Panther, Albert Big Man Howard, in an interview with the family of Hispanic teen James Rivera, who was shot and killed by police in Stockton, California. Tomorrow's weather is patchy fog in the morning, with a high of 59 degrees by the afternoon, with a chance of rain.
It's 5:20. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Let us all now bow before the God of free enterprise, whose awesomeness was revealed in a recent news release announcing that the divine managers of fast food demigod McDonald's achieved a profit of $1.5 billion in just 3 months this summer. Holy Big Mac! How did it do that? Peek behind the curtain and you'll see that McDonald's secret power is thee and me, America's taxpayers. The corporation rips off its huge workforce by paying poverty wages and no benefits, then directs the workers to the food stamp office and other government-funded safety net programs. Neat, huh? A major chunk of the chain's cost of doing business disappears from the corporate books and, shazam, reappears on the government's books. In fact, the National Employment Law Project reports that McDonald's phenomenal $1.5 billion profit is bloated by an estimated $1.2 billion that we taxpayers will shell out this year to support its predatory wage and benefit policy. Aren't you loving it, as the chain's ads say? But the Golden Arches are not alone in this fast food flim-flam. The conglomerate owner of Kentucky Fried Chicken, Pizza Hut, and Taco Bell duns us for $648 million to underwrite its poverty pay. Subway burrows into us for $436 million. Burger King, a British outfit, taps us for $356 million. Little Sweet Wendy's grabs more than a quarter billion bucks from us, and Dunkin' Donuts dips into our pockets for $274 million. And look here, it's Domino's Pizza, whose extremist right-wing owner says he hates government spending. But he's picking the taxpayers' pockets to the tune of $126 million to subsidize his free enterprise. This is Jim Hightower saying, the corporate powers preach about the magic of the marketplace, but magicians don't do magic, they perform illusions.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The group that is opposing Initiative 522 had another $540,000 donated by Monsanto Company on Monday. Initiative 522 is a Washington state ballot measure to require foods that have been processed with genetically modified organisms to be labeled as genetically engineered. Monsanto Company produces chemicals such as pesticides and herbicides that are harmful to consumers of the foods that the chemical is put on. No on Initiative 522 has raised almost $22 million for their campaign, setting them at a state record. The group opposing 522 says that having GMO products labeled as such will drive up the costs for farmers and food production companies, making the items cost more for individuals. The supporting group of Initiative 522 says people purchasing the items have a right to know if there are GMOs in their product. Monsanto and other big food producers are against 522 because it will drive up their costs.
A federal judge in Texas has ruled that some of the elements of a restrictive anti-abortion bill are unconstitutional. The ruling will allow a number of clinics to remain open, particularly those in rural areas where access to abortion is difficult in Texas. But women's rights advocates have noted that the ruling is a mixed blessing. While it does allow clinics to stay open for the time being, it also places increased restrictions on access to the so-called morning after pill. If that happens, it will be a major challenge to the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision, allowing women across the U.S. access to abortions. This decision is being watched by other states attempting to pass anti-abortion bills. Texas Attorney General Greg Abbott, and likely GOP gubernatorial candidate, immediately filed an appeal in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans, saying he has no doubt this will go all the way to the Supreme Court. After the judge's ruling, Texas State Senator Wendy Davis, who filibustered against this bill and is now a candidate for governor, commented that, as a mother, she would rather see tax dollars spent on improving education rather than defending this law.
As people around the country face increasingly difficult choices regarding housing, Pacifica reporter Rebecca Bowring brings us the report on how some people are looking into unconventional alternatives.
23-year-old Genevieve Angle lives on water. A receptionist at a fertility clinic in San Francisco, she makes the short commute across the bay from this marina in Alameda. That's where she set up home aboard a 32-foot powerboat. It has a kitchen, toilet, two bedrooms, even central heating. Genevieve loves living here, but it's a lifestyle choice she made for financial reasons.
I wanted to live in San Francisco, but it's too expensive, and in reality, everywhere is too expensive. So my dad convinced me to buy a boat, sell it in a couple years when I don't want it anymore, and then I'll practically break even.
Genevieve owns her boat outright and says the monthly cost of living savings are huge.
I pay about $400 for the slip fees and for my water and utilities. I figure if I was living in a one-bedroom place in San Francisco, I'm not going to get it in a decent part of town for less than $1,500.
In some San Francisco neighborhoods, the cost of renting an apartment has doubled over the last year. Plenty of young professionals earn a respectable wage, but they're increasingly choosing to opt out of paying large sums to landlords. Blogger Tynan lives in an RV or mobile home. In a city where parking is a daily nightmare, he's afraid of being evicted from his spot.
If you park in a really nice neighborhood and people see your RV and they see that you're kind of flouting convention, you're not paying for rent in this place where they're paying a lot of money, they do get upset, and so they'll call the police.
An influx of tech workers has ramped up pressure on San Francisco's housing stock. Sarah Karlinski, deputy director of the urban planning think tank Spur, says lower and middle class residents are being priced out.
As these millionaires and multimillionaires come to the city, it can be just enormously disruptive to the fabric because people end up having to go.
During the recession, San Francisco barely built any new homes. Now there are belatedly about 6,000 units under construction, and the city's become a leader in the provision of affordable housing.
With every new unit of market rate housing that's constructed, developers need to either pay a fee to construct affordable housing or they need to build below market rate units within their buildings themselves.
So far, demand for this kind of low-income housing is far outstripping supply. But San Francisco city leaders hope that in time they can close the housing affordability gap before too many long-standing residents are forced to move away. Rebecca Bowring, San Francisco.
A protest to stop the Keystone XL pipeline was held this morning in Portland as part of a national day of action against the proposed pipeline. KBOO's Genevieve McDaniel spoke with one of the participants in the protest.
So tell us about this morning's protest.
We met at Strunk Plaza, the idea being that we would go around to the four buildings involved in supporting of the pipeline. The point was we're showing off the nasty, evil companies that are involved in the whole coal project to degrade our environment. What they were doing was delivering letters to each of these companies, putting them on notice that we will be back prepared to do civil disobedience to stop these terrible projects. So that was the whole mission. And then afterwards, I was asking the lady, how come there were no TV cameras here? She said, well, AP was here. But I said, but no local TV. I said, that seemed unusual to me, even more unusual because I was at the Sierra Club sponsored protest at Holiday Park against the pipeline, and it was the same thing. I did not see anyone with a big local news camera, so I was very suspicious. I think most people in power and in power positions are supporting the whole tar sands thing because they're going to make money on it. And it just, I'm very passionate about this, that I'm just sick of the only people that want the projects that degrade our environment are people that are greedy enough to want to make money off of it. And it's just so sick to me. That and crazy that people would be that short-sighted that we're going to give ourselves cancer, you know, from the polluted farmland and polluted organic farms from the coal dust. We're going to give ourselves cancer and, you know, a whole population. We're going to destroy the air because when they burn the coal, the air will come back to us as smog.
What is the negative impact of the Keystone XL pipeline?
The negative impact? There's so many on so much on many levels, as I mentioned. When this coal goes to Asia or China, wherever it's going, it will come back to us when they burn it because it's the most toxic kind of fuel that you can deal with. I mean, well, other than nuclear, it makes a lot of smoke. Then I guess I'm kind of going in reverse. That's when it comes back to us. But then also, as the trains go through, there is dust that's left. And sometimes it's not even dust. The dust is, it's like lumps. It's lumps of coal dust. And that is very toxic and will pollute the water and it will pollute the soil. And there are organic farmers that are going to lose their organic status just because their land is too close to where this is going through. Oh, and then there's danger of transporting oil through many, many miles, you know, coal and then oil. It's like, oh my gosh, this is just accidents waiting to happen. And we already know that the infrastructure of trains stink because we've been spending all of our money for at least the last decade. We've been spending it on the 12 wars that we have had ongoing. We're sucked dry, so we're going to ship all this stuff on rail lines that are probably haven't had all the maintenance and everything that they should.
So is this why you became involved in the issue?
Yes, I just see all these issues that are happening. Like, oh, now we're going to drag coal trains? Like, everyone loves Portland because we took a stand that the environment was important. And it's not just that, oh, that Portlandia TV show, why people are so hot for Portland. We're hot for it because it's one of the last remaining places that really reveres and respects nature and people. And this is where it's so short-sighted by the 1%. People want to live in a place with clean air and trees and clean water and natural beauty. And right now, kind of the only people that are going to get that the way our country is moving is the really rich people. They can kind of pay to import it. But eventually, that's really not going to work because there's just one sky, you know? So
going back to having clean air, is this why Portlanders should be concerned?
Oh, yes, absolutely. If they value clean air, please, they should join our bandwagon and use all their free time to help fight this because this will terribly impact our air. All of Asia's burning of coal will come back to us and settle in our valley. And that all by itself would be reason to marshal a grand fight.
What was the public response to the protests this morning?
I think maybe head scratching because I think it might have been kind of hard to tell conceptually what exactly it was we were doing. A lot of people thanked us. And I get that response a lot to any activism work because I think so many people are behind us, but because of other commitments, they can't be on the street. So, yeah, I think the response was very, you know, it was very nice. We gave out a lot of brochures.
That's great. Thank you for talking with me. KBOO member and Keystone XL protester Holly Hansen. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Genevieve McDaniel with KBOO News.
The top two officials in charge of U.S. intelligence gathering efforts defended their methods in a congressional hearing today, while legislation was introduced in the Senate that reins in the agency's tools. Director of National Intelligence James Clapper describes the recent disclosures by Edward Snowden as an unfortunate development, which necessitates an open dialogue to restore public faith that the agency isn't abusing its authority. Here's a clip from Clapper's statement. We apologize for the technical glitch.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, October 29th, 2013. Israeli troops demolish Palestinian home in occupied Jerusalem and kidnap civilians from northern West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Several Israeli military jeeps and police vehicles accompanied by bulldozers invaded Beit Hanina in occupied East Jerusalem on Tuesday and demolished an apartment building. Local sources have reported that the building belongs to a resident in Al-Sharqiya area in Beit Hanina. The owner, Amin Shiuchi, said that dozens of soldiers invaded the area, declared it a closed military zone, and demolished the building without any warning. He added that the families were not even granted time to remove their furniture and belongings from the building. In related news, dozens of soldiers invaded Khirbet At-Tawil area, an eastern suburb of Nablus city in northern West Bank, and demolished a concrete water cistern in addition to two rooms. Khirbet At-Tawil has been subjected to frequent army attacks that led to the repeated destruction of homes and property. Elsewhere, Israeli troops invaded on Tuesday afternoon the village of Ya'bud near northern West Bank city of Jenin and kidnapped two residents. Local sources reported that troops invaded the village, searched and ransacked a number of homes before taking the two men to unknown location. Also on Tuesday, Israeli troops kidnapped a man from Jenin city as he was crossing a military checkpoint nearby. Witnesses said that the man was on his way home after work when troops stopped him, then searched him, and took him away without any reason. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, October 29th, 2013 News Roundup from the Occupied Palestinian Territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
The United Nations confirmed today that at least 10 babies and children in Syria have been sickened by polio. Symptoms of polio began to appear in Syria's Deir al-Zor province earlier this month. According to a spokesperson for the World Health Organization, of the 22 suspected cases of polio, 10 have been confirmed so far. Results for the remaining 12 cases are expected soon. The World Health Organization has planned an outbreak response immunization program. This program will undertake an emergency vaccination program over the next 6 months, aiming to vaccinate children in Syria and 7 nearby countries.
A group of protesters in New York City gathered last night outside a fundraiser for U.S. Representative and potential candidate for Governor Alison Schwartz. They called on Schwartz to stand up against the proposed fast-tracking of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. President Obama has requested that Congress grant him fast-track authority, which will allow him to force Congress to vote on free trade agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership without having a chance to discuss or amend it. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Adam Weissman of TradeJustice.net, who says that fast-tracking of trade agreements is a violation of the Constitution.
Adam, can you tell us about yesterday's protest that you helped organize? What was the focus?
Sure. Representative Allison Schwartz is one of the Democratic representatives who has failed as of yet to speak out against President Obama's request for fast-track authority with regard to trade agreements. Fast-track is a process that really undermines constitutional separation of powers by giving the executive branch the power to negotiate trade agreements and then send them to Congress with 90
credits.
Days to vote on them, with limited floor debate and with the lack of any
that
ability to amend these agreements
you.
In any
right.
way. And given that, as we've seen in the past, free trade
right.
agreements like NAFTA and CAFTA endanger
yeah,
our environmental
that's right. okay.
rules, outsource jobs to sweatshops, give corporations new powers to attack public interest legislation by bringing cases in international tribunals demanding compensation when our public interest laws interfere with their potential future profits. Free trade agreements raise prices on drugs by expanding corporate patent rights, are used by the banks to prevent regulation, preventing another financial crisis that they expect will bail them out of the next time their own greed trips them up again. So free trade agreements in the NAFTA model are really a tool for expanding corporate power and expanding corporate profits at the expense of the public interest. Representative Schwartz is one of these reps who still has not spoken out in opposition to this fast-track process and has failed to really assert her right to represent her constituents in Congress rather than rubber stamping these kind of trade agreements. She and her other representatives should not be ceding that power. They should be standing up for their constituents and making sure that our trade agreements and U.S. trade policy is reflective of what constituents want, and if it's not, they should be voting against these trade agreements. We also had signs with messages like Trans-Pacific FTA, the TPP, also known as the TPP, helps corporations attack financial services regulations. We had signs about how TPP is called the Global Monsanto Protection Act because Monsanto is one of the corporations heavily pushing this agreement, and it will force force countries to drop their bans on genetically modified foods and potentially endanger the right of countries to label genetically modified foods. So really, again, these are trade agreements that are not designed to create prosperity for working people, but really designed to eviscerate all the work that popular movements have done over the course of decades to protect our food supply, to protect our environment, really all the things that movements using the tools of democracy to rein in unchecked corporate power are at risk through these trade agreements. And fast track is a procedure designed to force Congress into rubber stamping these agreements rather than having any say in what they look like.
That was KBOO's Jenka Soderberg, who spoke with Adam Weissman of TradeJustice.net. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Rosalind Scott, Genevieve McDaniel, Robin Ryan, and Don Merrill. The producer is Sequoia Wright. Special thanks to KBOO News reporter Joe Meyer. Our engineer is Sequoia Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. And in our daily report of radiation counts, the RADcast, produced by No Nukes Northwest, today's radiation readings in North Portland is 39 counts per minute, or CPM, with highs spiking at 60 CPM. In Beaverton, today's levels are 32 CPM with a high of 53. In Damascus, the reading is 31 CPM, high 44. Powell Butte has 21 CPM, high 46. In Seaside, Oregon, 33 CPM with a high of 51. And in Kirkland, Washington, the radiation count is 31 counts per minute with a high of 51. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.FM. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Nat Parker. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Lisa Loving hosts Wednesday Talk Radio, news and commentary on local, national, and international news. At 9, on Political Perspectives, the guest is investigative journalist Eric Schlosser, who talks about his new book, Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety, which focuses on accidents, near misses, extraordinary heroism, and technical breakthroughs in America's nuclear arsenal system. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, we hear Radio EcoShock on climate catastrophe past and future, with Peter Ward on the four past extinctions from global warming and how rising seas will change America forever. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support in our fall membership drive. Your station makes this possible. And stay tuned now for Linda Olsen Osterlund, host of A Deeper Look, in a live interview focusing on the impact of climate change on the world's oceans. Good night. Good night, Diane.
Good night, Nat. Have a good evening.
You too.
Good evening. This is Linda Olsen Osterlund with a special report on the impacts of climate change on the world's oceans. My guest is Andrew Thurber, a postdoctoral fellow at Oregon State University's College of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences. He's also the co-author of a just released study that concluded that over 98% of the world's oceans will be affected by multiple stressors by the year 2100, wreaking havoc with sea life. This is a quote, wreaking havoc with sea life. But, and also with the humans who depend on it for work and food. Welcome to KBOO, Andrew Thurber.
Thank you.
Is that Thurber? Am I saying your name incorrectly?
It's Thurber.
All right, great. Thank you for joining us. Well, let's get a little bit of background on the study at the beginning. Let's get it out of the way first. Who participated in this study, and how was it different, really, than any other study of its sort before?
So this study was really an international group of about 28 different scientists that got together and kind of thought of this question, and then we had a workshop located up in the San Juan Islands and decided that this was something we really needed to figure out, is how not only does one stressor impact the ocean, but where are going to be the places on the planet that are going to have multiple different sorts of stressors overlapping and causing potentially interacting problems for the marine life and the humans that depend on it.
So how did you go about tackling the problem of assessing this?
Well, so what we did was we used essentially the best climate models that we have, the ones that were part of the IPCC report that just came out, and we used 30.
Now, let's say what the IPCC is. That's the international, go ahead and say it.
International Panel on Climate Change.
And this is they're coming out with their fifth assessment.
Yeah, it just came out a couple weeks ago, maybe a month ago now.
And
so
you can,
it's the best information, the best models that we have for the future of the planet.
Okay, and so you use those models as a basis?
And we used as many as we could, which was 31 for one of the parameters we estimated, which was temperature, and between 10 and 11 for some of the other parameters. Well, we essentially predicted how two different climate scenarios are going to kind of interact in, essentially, I guess it's not quite 87 years now, 2100, and found that essentially 98% of the ocean is not going to experience just one stressor, but are going to be impacted by multiple stressors.
And you focused on four particular stressors, is that correct?
That is. So we focused on overall surface temperature of the ocean, or actually overall temperature of the ocean. The study was unique for a variety of reasons. You asked this earlier, but one of which is that we took the ocean, not just the surface, but from the surface all the way to the deep sea. And then the other thing is that we looked at all four of these stressors on a global scale. So we looked at temperature, which is one of the better studied stressors, and then also pH, all the CO2 that we're releasing into the atmosphere.
What we call ocean acidification.
Exactly. Is increasing and is going to continue to increase as we continue to release more CO2. And then we also looked at oxygen, because the kind of circulation of the ocean and different productivity can lead to reduced oxygen in the ocean, and that can lead to dead zones and sort of a very clear impact to certain fauna. The final one we looked at was productivity. So that's essentially how much of the energy captured from the sun is going to change. Is it the same as now, or is it going to be reduced? We found in most places it's going to be reduced. So that's less energy that goes into the base of the food web.
And part of my understanding of what has been changing the ocean so dramatically is the fact that 90% of our CO, or the warmth that's coming from global warming, is actually being held in the sea.
I don't know that number off the top of my head, so I can't correct or...
I saw it in an IPCC report today when I was reading it. That was one of the numbers that was there. But let's talk about the really startling... The other parameter of the study was that you looked at the impacts on humans who work on the sea, humans who depend on the sea for food, and also humans who just live near these areas that are going to have these multiple stressors. Can you talk about the conclusions that you, or you know, the what you saw when you were looking at that?
Yeah, what we found was that there were about 2 billion people on the planet that are dependent on the ocean that will be impacted to some extent by this. That's billion with a B. However,
2 billion people.
Yeah,
kind of hard for us to put together in terms of seeing what that would mean.
Yeah, so that's essentially a little less than a third, maybe a quarter of the population now predicted out would be impacted. But we also really wanted to know of the people that could adapt and the people that couldn't adapt. And as a measure of that, we looked at essentially how many people don't make very much money and are dependent on the ocean. Because if you think about some place like the United States, in many regards, we're going to be able to deal with that because we have so much money behind us. We have the facilities to retool fishing fleets if there's a new species that comes in, or shift the fish stock that we're dealing with. However, if you're a subsistence fisherman who essentially has to capture your food from the ocean every day for your family, and you make very little money, and we use that cutoff as about $4,000 a year, you're going to be much less likely to be able to drastically change either the tools that you have to use to collect or buy different nets, use different boats, et cetera, to collect different food sources, or change jobs entirely. So we found that depending on which one of the scenarios we chose, whether we chose the one that had the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere at 550 parts per million or 900 parts per million, that would change that number from about 400 million people to 800 million people are not only very much dependent on the ocean, but also make very little money a year. And so we're going to be less likely to kind of be able to roll with the punches compared to some of the better off countries on the planet.
And when we're talking about some of the impacts they'll be facing, we're talking about the food that normally, the fish they normally pull from the sea not being there. So that's going to mean people will begin to migrate, I'm assuming.
I don't know if migrate's going to be the right
word.
There's just going to be less food. And there's also, I mean, there's
people will move to try to find food where they can, just like all species of animals, I assume.
Yeah. And there's, I mean, one of the main discussion or things that are often brought up, like, well, aren't there going to be positive things with global warming? Well, how do you view positive? There's going to be changes. And if you have somebody who's adapted and lived for hundreds, thousands of years, adapted to one thing, if you change their environment, that's still going to stress them. So even though you may have a shift in species ranges, so in other words, you have warm water species expanding farther northward, that still means that there's going to be a different sort of way that needs to be harnessing those species if they're going to be a foodstuff. And then all those species that are expanding northward, we now would call those invasive species, although it will be a more of a shift of the different populations around the globe.
So when we're talking about the stressors that are going to be impacted and that it will vary in different parts, one part of your report said the northern hemisphere in general appears to be in real trouble and the Pacific Northwest is highlighted there. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, one of the reasons that we're impacted is because we are in the Pacific Northwest is because we have a strong upwelling-driven productivity on our coast. And so what that means is that we already have environments that are generally dealing with oxygen stress. And when you have oxygen stress, that low oxygen also coincides with high CO2 concentrations, which leads to ocean acidification. So we're one of the areas, along with kind of the other upwelling zones on the planet, that are going to have mixtures of oxygen stress and ocean acidification stress, and then temperature is going to be most of the globe, except for some areas potentially in the Southern Ocean near Antarctica. So we have all three of those stressors going at the same time. We also have a predicted mild change in productivity, so less food at the base of the food web.
Well, and I wondered about that. I mean, I did a story with Mr. Wahlberg about the ocean acidification. I know our oyster beds are affected, and people are working hard to adapt to that. I don't know how long they can continue to come up with adaptations that will allow us to grow oysters here. But we're also talking about food networks, food webs that include things like bases of the food chains, like krill. Can you talk about that and what that will mean as it goes forward? Because we can look to 2100 and say 98% of them will be affected, but there will be these changes going forward every day.
Yeah, so you said krill. That was actually one of the environments that, or the kind of groups that was going to be largest under the greatest multiple stressors, and that they really form a huge amount of the base of the food web for everything from cetaceans to fish stocks all over the planet as Northern Hemisphere, Southern Hemisphere. And so that's going to be, if they are impacted as we're predicted, that's going to not only impact the lower and medium food webs, but that's going to go all the way up to the high food webs. And so that's really the central ocean functioning that's going to be altered.
And so while you looked at the populations that are directly related to living and working on the sea, aren't the rest of us on the planet very much related to the sea in terms of it being a food source? I think, for example, just all of the rivers, the network of rivers that go to the ocean and the different fish that are part ocean, part river, etc., just all of those changes, but also sources of food. Aren't we all going to be making major changes throughout this going forward?
Yeah, I think that's a good point, is that this is largely a conservative estimate in many regards, and so there are many more people who do get different things from the sea than just those that are cited. However, we tried to keep it more conservative than list everybody possible. So that also depends on what country you are, whether or not you get have access to fresh food, fresh seafood all around the country like we do here.
Yes, with distribution network. Well, thank you for so much for joining me, Andrew Thruber, oceanographer with OSU's College of Earth's Ocean and Atmospheric Sciences. Thanks for joining us today on KBIO, and thank you for your work with the world's oceans.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And now stay tuned for Out Loud.
Thank you so much to everyone who contributed to our recently completed fall membership drive. Your generosity keeps KBOO on the air. We ended the drive Saturday at 5 p.m., about $10,000 shy of our financial goal. If you missed your chance to donate during the drive, just go to kboo.fm right now and make your contribution. If you did pledge and still need to send us your payment, please aim to do so this week. Thanks very much again to everyone who values KBOO and helps keep it on the air.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to help co-sponsor the Triangle production of American Fiesta, starring Gary Wayne Cash, a witty, hopeful tale of imperfection and acceptance. American Fiesta will take place at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. This Triangle production will run from November 29th through December 22nd. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair-accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
Welcome to Out Loud, the queer culture radio show here on KBOO. My name is Carla, and tonight we are going to be discussing Wild Planet Radio, a new low-powered FM radio station focusing on the queer community that is in the works here in Portland and will hopefully, fingers crossed, be broadcasting early next year. So we're going to be talking with the creative master